What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Though you can call me Dee Dee or Angelica or Patricia.
That outfit's wearing you, Felix.
Why are you calling me Felix? My name is Joe.
I'm calling you Felix because I do what I want.
That's Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan as one of her three characters in Joe vs. the Volcano. Inspired by Hanks' new film, Cloud Atlas, we'll do what we want by counting down our top five multiple role performances.
We'll also cross continents and generations in search of the true with the discussion of Cloud Atlas.
I hope it's a fat, juicy slice, name none of your burnt wafery offerings.
Wow, well done. All that and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. You're listening to Film Spotting. We'll recognize our favorite performances by actors pulling double, triple, and maybe even octuple duty in the Film Spotting Top 5 later in the show. And oh, Superfly, you're going to make your fortune by and by. We'll discuss the second film in our Blaxploitation Marathon.
You really should have done that in your falsetto, you know.
Not pretty.
First, this review of Cloud Atlas will amount to no more than a few words in a limitless conversation. Yet what is any movie review but a multitude of words?
Yesterday, my life was headed in one direction. Today, it is headed in another.
You ever think the universe is against you?
Fear. Belief. Love. Phenomena that determine the course of our lives. These forces begin long before we are born and continue after we perish.
Past and present. And by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future.
I had a brilliant plan this week to construct an elaborate setup for Cloud Atlas that would reflect the movie's ambition. First, I'd change costumes and apply new makeup every few lines. But then I remembered that you're the only one who can see me, Josh, and there was no way I was going to work that hard for an audience of one.
Good point.
I also remembered that I have no actual acting or writing talent, so my plan B, to alternate between different voices, dialects, and languages the way the movie swings between six separate but oh-so-connected stories spanning at least 300 years, wasn't going to work either. I'm afraid then you're stuck with my usual straightforward, stuffily read prose. We get the tale of Adam Ewing, a young notary traveling across the Pacific Ocean with a slave stowaway, the young composer Robert Frobisher, an aspiring musician assisting a famous composer in 1930s Belgium, Halle Berry's investigative journalist trying to uncover a corporate conspiracy in mid-70s San Francisco, the in-over-his-head publisher, Timothy Cavendish, trying to escape from a present-day nursing home, and I haven't even mentioned Sonmi 451, a genetically engineered clone living in 22nd century Neo-Seoul, or Zachary, Tom Hanks's primitive nature man living in an unnamed post-apocalyptic future. It might have been particularly fun to voice everything in Zachary's sing-songy gibberish, but then I would have needed to understand more than every eighth word he said. Apparently, I should have consulted you first. You have it down.
I speak it fluently.
Fantastic. Hanks, like Barry and the other talented members of Cloud Atlas's ensemble cast, including Jim Broadbent, Hugh Grant, and Ben Whishaw, play unique characters in most, if not all, of the six storylines. So if there's one thing that should be clear by now, it's that this adaptation of David Mitchell's acclaimed 2004 novel, co-directed by Run Lola Run's Tom Tykwer and The Matrix's Lana and Andy Wachowski, is not your standard Hollywood fare. It's bold, it's big, and to borrow a phrase from our friends across the pond, might just all be bollocks. But Josh, one benefit of essentially having six different films in one is that even if you find one storyline to be especially boring or even aggravating, you know you just have to hang with it for a few minutes before being whisked away quantum leap style to another narrative dimension. Was there one story in particular that captivated you more than the others? And did it contain enough mystery and inspire enough awe to transport you willingly on this audacious journey?
Not at all, really, but I don't hold that against the film. I hadn't even really, that's an interesting question. I hadn't considered it that way or even necessarily tried to latch onto one story or was looking for that to latch onto because I was so impressed with this film's construction. And I think some of the storytelling is maybe a weaker aspect of the film, but its construction, how they pulled this off, I think they do pull it off, was so impressive to me just in terms of moving fluidly among all of these narratives. It sounded like an impossibility. And once I got a better feel, I really knew nothing about the film until a few weeks ago.
But that was something a lot of people said about it, supposedly, was that David Mitchell's novel was unfilmable.
Yes.
It was one of those.
Once I started hearing that and read about the interconnected narratives and all these different people playing roles in each one, I thought, how is this thing going to be anything but a mess? And honestly, looking at particularly the last Matrix film in the trilogy, it seemed like something that could go wrong in the way that movie did. This film is so fluid, moving from narrative to narrative. You never get lost in it at any time, yet it doesn't feel simplistic to me. It really is symphonic. And that's something, obviously, that the film is going for. There's a musical piece called The Cloud Atlas Sextet that appears in more than one of the narratives. So this is a clear model they're using, but I'm still impressed that they pulled it off. And I think the actors being in multiple roles plays into that. It's not just a gimmick, because what you get by these reoccurring faces, sometimes there are other times you don't even recognize it's the same actor. But quite a lot of the time, you do recognize that they've appeared before. It's kind of like when a symphonic piece hits chords similarly in different movements. So you hear a chord that maybe struck you the movement before, or something like that. And they reverberate against each other, and it really lends to this richness. Now, this is all working on, like I said, the level of construction. I never fully engaged the film in terms of emotion or theme or anything like that. But the fact that it works so well on the construction level made me like it.
Well, it sounds like the film did strike more or less the same chord with us, though, as I'll probably get to later, it did hit me on an emotional level by the end of the film. There were one or two stories in particular that I was most drawn into. As I said, we'll get to that. But I do want to start by saying probably the least analytical, most ridiculous thing I've ever said on this show, which is saying something over 7.5 years of doing it. But I swear I had this experience. It was Saturday afternoon. It had been about 24 hours since I saw the movie. So it's still swirling around in my head, which this movie, I think, is going to do for most people who don't just outright dismiss it. And I was taking a nap with my 2-year-old son, Connor. It's a tough job, but he doesn't take naps. So you have to lay down with him. He just will not do it.
Sure, I'm not buying this for a second.
You're not. I didn't figure you would, but it's the truth. So I'm laying down with Connor. I'm in one of these semi-coherent states where you feel like you're asleep part of the time, you're awake part of the other time, and I'm replaying scenes from the movie in my head. The whole thing is swirling around, and somehow, I swear to you, Josh, it's all fitting together. I'm making connections I didn't see in the theater between the different sequences. Everything clicked into place for me, and then I woke up. And it was gone.
You lost it.
I came to and it was gone. Like Jim Broadbent's composer character in the film when he's lamenting the symphony he lost in his dream. That was me. And I couldn't help but think, if only the Wachowskis and Tickfer could market Cloud Atlas to moviegoers who are in a constant dream state, they'd be gold. This movie would be box office gold, because the experience, on a serious note, of watching this movie is a bit like having a dream, with these characters appearing in different and unexpected places, making huge leaps in time and space, and it being fragmented, but all adding up to, like a dream, a feeling you wake up with about whatever it is you've just been through, and then you're trying to make sense of it. I think the movie does beg to be dissected and potentially dismissed, but somehow through its sheer grandiosity and ultimately its generosity of spirit, it works. Somehow the movie works.
It does work. And maybe it's because you're searching for something in your dream state that might not be there. I think what this movie is interested in is right there on the surface for you. And one of its faults, I would say, is how often it repeatedly hammers those concerns in terms of characters who are facing oppression of one sort or another, seeking freedom, seeking to be recognized for who they are, be validated for their identity, even if it might break convention. I mean, there are clear parallels in each of these narrative threads.
For sure.
And the movie hits them quite hard. Maybe one underlying thing that I found interesting was this idea of inaction being a form of complicity.
Right.
There are a number of characters who don't take action and pay the price for that. And then in some of the strands,
they think about not taking action but do, and you see a different variation.
As I was watching it, I was thinking about the word cowardice. I think that's an element.
Yeah.
You either have to act or you sit back and are afraid to act.
For sure. And those things are very clearly there and repeated. Again, that's part of the structure, but for some reason for me, having characters reappear over and over, or actors, I should say, or faces, was more effective to me than having the same theme be told to me over and over. That began to get a little overbearing for me. I guess that was the weakness I felt.
I could see that, but for me as well, the forced casting across all six stories did pose a problem where it wasn't so much offensive as just distracting. You've got a black woman, Halle Berry, playing a white woman at one point. You've got an Asian woman playing white. You've got whites playing Asian. You've got whites playing future forest people who we have no idea what they would really be like. And Tom Hanks as well, everybody he plays. I love Tom Hanks as an actor. I really do. And I hate putting him in a box. But he's one of those movie stars who I feel like is just at his best when he's playing a variation of himself.
He's a star more than an actor.
Exactly. And he's at his worst when he's playing characters, when he's taking on traits and kind of working from the outside in. I tend to have problems with him. And I think Forrest Gump actually is one exception where I think he's definitely playing a character with really distinct traits. And yet I really like him and think he gets to the core of that character. But watching him here in all six of these different roles just struck me as fun in a Saturday Night Live skit sort of way, or an award show parody, like something you'd see before the Oscars. But over the course of 172 minutes, it becomes its own kind of bad joke. It feels more like we're being winked at than really being engaged. So unfortunately, Tom Hanks wasn't a strength of this movie for me. And I think the theatricality of the comedy in general felt very forced to me. There's just a terrible scene where Bai Duna, I hope I'm saying her name right, she's the Asian actress who is wonderful in the Somni 451 storyline. She's the main character there. She's playing a Mexican woman and has this horrible punchline after hitting somebody with a frying pan.
That's
or something.
Really strange scene.
It's really strange. Everything about that sequence
is
strange.
In a number of ways.
Everything about that seemed gratuitous. And unfortunately, there are a few elements like that. That was the clangiest of all of them to me, but there are several like that, unfortunately.
I don't think comedy is the strongest thing about the film.
No.
Even that whole section with Jim Broadbent trying to escape the nursing home, which is supposed to be kind of a comic relief section, I don't think that works very well at all. But let me get back to Hanks, because I agree with you in a couple other roles he plays. There's one which is this kind of gangster author, I guess. It's a very brief scene that doesn't work at all.
No.
I think his primitive nature man, which is how you put it, and I like that. I was searching for what to call him in my written review. I didn't know. I think he's very good as the primitive nature man.
I think that's one of his better ones,
without a doubt. I think that works quite a bit. And maybe, I'm still thinking about your question because it hadn't occurred to me before, that may be the storyline that I did find most arresting in terms of just grabbing me and being more involved when it came back on the screen. I kind of sat up a little bit more and was like, okay, let's see what's going to happen now, where the others I let wash over me. And I think Hanks was a big part of that.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson discussing the new film from co-directors Lana and Andy Wachowski and Tom Tickfer. It's called Cloud Atlas. A lot of that post-apocalyptic future sequence with Hanks and Halle Berry as the two main stars was lost on me. And I think, as we joked about earlier in the segment, a lot of that just comes back to the fact that you really can't understand what they're saying for the most part. And I know that's an easy thing to pick on. I have a feeling that when I watch this film again, and I do look forward to watching this film again, and I see it on Blu-ray and I can turn the subtitles on, I'll probably have a different experience with that sequence. But especially when you get near the end of the film and he and Halle Berry are engaged in conversations that really are at the root of the entire conflict, the entire reason why we're watching this sequence, getting into all the important issues and tying it into the rest of the film, I didn't know what was going on. I have to confess, I mostly had no idea what they were saying to each other.
I haven't spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, but I didn't know while watching it what in the world she was doing on the mountaintop.
Exactly.
So it's that sort of stuff. I'm sure if I pieced it together, I could probably come up with a theory, but the movie just didn't engage me on the level, at least where I put that effort in.
I'll also point out that, as you noted, I do think it is more symphonic than simplistic, but there are those moments where that whole everything is connected conceit of the film, cutting between the storylines, I got it. And early on, I love some of the ways they emphasize that connectiveness visually very subtly. There would sometimes be just a physical motion where a character in one sequence would be turning a certain way, and then they'd cut to the next story, and the character is completing the turn. It's a nice visual match on action, but there can be too much of a good thing, and the connections start becoming more and more obvious and more tedious, where every time a character is falling down, we then cut to someone fall down in the next sequence, or someone uses a certain phrase or a certain word, and in the next sequence, they almost pick up right after that. I started to feel like, okay, I got it. You could actually dial this back a little bit, and I'd be more engaged with this film and less distracted by the technique of what you're doing.
That's really interesting, because I never found that tedious. I found the repeating of the themes more tedious, but the visual stuff, I really liked how that continued and built. Probably the standout scene for me is the one, I think it comes about midpoint, and you do have to let this movie get started. You have to let it set up all its narratives and times and places before it can start playing with them and meshing them together. So I think this is midpoint. Again, it leads back to this theme of oppression and escaping oppression. There's an attempted liberation sequence. Mm-hmm. So you have a slave leaping from a ship's mast in 1849, and then we cut, and these are parallel cutting, going back and forth to a fugitive's escape via this sky bridge that's going between the skyscrapers in Neo Seoul. Mm-hmm. I liked how both of those scenes are employing height and fear of height, and so they're amplifying each other. And what's interesting that it also does is there's a third strain, at least a third strain. There may be a fourth that I'm forgetting, but there's a third strain of Halle Berry's journalist sneaking into an office at a nuclear power plant where she's not supposed to be. There isn't anything particularly suspenseful about that, but because it's being cut back and forth with these other two extremely suspenseful high action scenes, it amplifies her scene as well.
Yeah.
So I was really impressed by how that worked, and similar things go on throughout the film.
I like that same sequence you're describing and the way it intercuts those three sequences. I think those moments for me would be even more fully realized or more amplified and more effective for me if every time they cut to a new storyline, they didn't find some clever way to match the action. I think I would enjoy moments like that more. But let's get to what I did really appreciate about this film. And it gets back to what you said in terms of not really engaging with the themes of the movie. I did ultimately engage with one big theme of the film, and I think you summed it up well in terms of freedom and oppression being a major one that we see in every sequence. We talked a little bit about cowardice or acting, but the big one that hooked me, and people who listen to the show regularly will expect that this is something that would hook me, and it ultimately moved me, was how it revealed or explored this fundamental need to express yourself. And that is part of freedom and oppression, of course, because one way you take away someone's freedom is by stifling their ability to speak, stop their story from being published or their music from being heard, whatever it is. You can essentially negate or invalidate their lives that way. Each story we see in this film, storytelling plays a major role in the lives of these characters. The leads in every story are, in fact, storytellers one way or another, whether they're writing a journalistic piece, constructing the sextet, or they're sitting around a campfire telling stories to kids and other family members. Whatever it is, someone is always writing a journal. It's there in every sequence. They document their personal experiences and beliefs into some piece of art. They translate it into some piece of art. And we actually see over the course of the film how most of these characters get to rewrite their stories and create new paths for themselves. So that was something that I really engage with. And as I said, by the end of the film, the emotional core for me really comes from two sequences in particular. It's the Tom Tickford-directed Letters from Zettelgem. It's the Belgium sequence with Ben Whishaw as the aspiring composer, with Jim Broadbent as kind of his mentor. That sequence, as he tries to realize his ambitions and construct his life's work, put his entire life into that symphony, that one, and then also the Somni 451 sequence directed by the Wachowskis. That one, similarly, about a character trying to give her treatise, give her words, her statement, her testimony to the world and express herself that way. Those two are the ones that really hooked me.
Now, I noticed that you paid attention. I think it's in the end credits where they describe who directed what sequences. Could you tell otherwise without looking at that? Who did what? Was it obvious to you?
I have
because
to be honest,
to me, it was perfectly seamless.
I didn't think about it throughout the film at all.
Right, that's
it was
what
something
I
didn't want to think about. Mm-hmm. But looking later and seeing how it broke down, Tickford directed three, of course, the Wachowskis directed three. It's not a surprise at all. The Ben Whishaw one I'm describing with the composer, that felt very much to me like the movie Perfume, which Tickford directed with Ben Whishaw as a star. The Sanmi 451 sequence has a ton of elements right out of mm-hmm. The Matrix and Speed Racer. So certainly that was something that, looking back on it later, surprised me how much I was able to see elements of their work in those sequences. You really can, if you think about it, identify the director's hands at work in these segments.
Yeah, I think if I were asked to pick and predict which one's going in and just got the storylines alone, I might have been able to do it. But I was still really surprised how they gelled. This did not feel at all like an omnibus film where
right.
you clearly have different styles. I mean, they really work together beautifully as three directors. You know, I know that the Wachowskis are a team, but still, you've got three sensibilities at work here, and it's all of a piece.
It really is. And while I'm talking about the storytelling element and that theme that really grabbed me, I think as well, if I wanted to apologize for them or defend some of the clanginess in the dialogue, some of the lack of subtlety sometimes that I think we both would want in this movie ideally, the fact is, one of the things you have to think about, and we're not going to be able to get into it here, and I don't even have it all fully developed in my mind, but it's never completely clear how many of the stories we're seeing are supposed to be quote-unquote real, or are themselves actually constructs, completely fictional, or based on the lives of the characters involved, but nevertheless dramatized. It's not actually clear. So what I'm saying is, when you look back on a sequence like the Timothy Cavendish one, where I look at some of the performances and the over-the-top way the comedy doesn't really appeal to me at all, it's only upon later reflection do you realize that, well, it is a construct. It is someone creating this drama. It's not supposed to be real. So maybe that effective theatricality is actually justified.
I suppose that's a possibility. I haven't really thought about it that deeply either. And on top of that, you could add the whole layer of past and future lives as a possible theme.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was going to hit that more, but I didn't really get the impression that that was necessarily the case, that each actor was playing another variation of who they played before, just in another life. I mean, it might work out in some of the characters, but it was in a way a little more interesting than that. It was a little more complicated.
I agree. And speaking of that word complicated, I do think it's worth pointing out to people who are maybe listening to this discussion and thinking, maybe this sounds like something they don't want to participate in, seeing this movie, it sounds a little bit too crazy. I was surprised going in, even though I hadn't read anything about it, I saw comments certainly online that suggested, oh, this is kind of a mess and you're going to leave bewildered. It's pretty straightforward. Don't get me wrong. There are lots of things we're talking about that show that there are tons of open questions and ambiguities, and you can analyze this film up and down, just like we would The Master or The Shining or some other films we've talked about recently on the show. But that said, from a pure following the plot standpoint,
oh, sure.
Other than not knowing what Tom Hanks is saying during the future sequences, it's very easy. I don't think this is a movie that really will lose anybody unless you're not trying.
No, you're not going to get lost at all. And I think that's very much to its credit, given the material they were dealing with.
I do want to close with a note about how truly in this film everything is connected. As I said, maybe sometimes too much so. But there's a point where Jim Broadbent's character in the Cavendish sequence actually invokes Soylent Green.
He oh, yes.
quotes the famous line from Soylent Green. And of course, I had a laugh at it because I like the movie Soylent Green and I know that line and I got what he was going for there with that joke. But it actually comes
it
into
echoes.
Play.
It echoes.
It actually comes into play. Nothing is wasted here. If there's a reference to something, it's probably going to factor
yep.
in one way or another. I love that about this movie. So Cloud Atlas is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Cue the Curtis Mayfield. Our review of Superfly, the second film in our Blaxploitation Marathon, is next, right after an action-packed edition of Massacre Theater. Stay with us.
Home again, home again. One day I know I feel home again. Home again, home again. One day I know I feel strong again. Lift my head. Many times I've been told all this talk will make you old. So I'll close my eyes, look behind, moving on, moving on. So I'll close my eyes. Look behind, moving on. Lost again, lost again. One day I know I'll pass through force again.
It's been a few weeks since we've had listener recommendations for audiobooks from Audible.com, and we did get a couple, so we want to get to those in just a minute. Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered.
And our first recommendation comes from listener Carl Gregg from Frederick, Maryland. Here's an Audible recommendation for your Blaxploitation Marathon, Michael Chabon's new novel, Telegraph Avenue. From a recent New York Magazine article about the book, Chabon does fictionalize American history by way of real American art forms, the more demotic, the better. Kung fu flicks, Blaxploitation, baseball cards. One of the deepest pleasures of Telegraph Avenue is how steeped it is in the cultural detritus of the 70s. Its characters wear leisure suits and say, stay fly, and drive cars big enough to scare the bejesus out of Jaws. If the book had a backbeat, it would be the Bois Chicka Bois of early Isaac Hayes.
Nice. That sounds like it would fit our marathon for sure. Caitlin Jackson also wrote in from Merritt Island, Florida. She says, time travel-y recommendations for Looper I have for you. A Wrinkle in Time and A Swiftly Tilting Planet, both by Madeline L'Engle. Read very well by Hope Davis and Jennifer Ely, respectively. A Wrinkle in Time you're probably familiar with since it's fairly popular. It has been a personal favorite of mine since I learned to read. It's the story of a girl, Meg, as she goes on an unconventional quest through time and space for her lost father and ends up caught up in a battle between good and evil. The audiobook version is really a fun listen, and I consider the book necessary reading for, well, everyone. A Swiftly Tilting Planet is a later and lesser-known installment in the series as A Wrinkle in Time, and is a more mature and more somber book, but it tackles time travel in a really unique and thoughtful way. It focuses on Meg's younger brother, Charles Wallace, as he goes on his own quest through time, possibly to save the world. Could you ask for higher stakes than that? Both books are available on Audible.
Caitlin reviews audiobooks, actually, and a lot more, including putting her own spin on a lot of our top five lists at her blog, Out Loud Writing. That's outloudwrites.wordpress.com if you're looking for more recommendations. And I have a recommendation of my own this week. A couple weeks ago, I downloaded and started listening to Nate Silver's book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And Nate Silver, to everyone listening who is following the political campaign closely, is probably familiar with him. He is the author of the 538 blog over at the New York Times, where he predicts the upcoming election. He's a forecaster, very good at what he does, got the 2008 election right. I think he got it right in 49 out of 50 states and called the overall winner as well. And it's interesting because I got this book a couple weeks ago, and now this week, just in the past few days, he's become this lightning rod for the campaigns because he's calling the election for Obama. He's saying right now the forecasting models that he uses, the numbers he crunches, show that Obama is somewhere between a 70 and 75% chance to win the election. And a lot of conservative bloggers and pundits are using that as evidence of his clear bias, that he must be infusing those polls and reading the numbers with his desire to have Barack Obama win, and they're calling it bogus. And it's just really funny to me because, especially if you read the book, you know how insane that is, and you know that it makes no sense for a guy who makes his living forecasting the correct results for him to lose all credibility by getting this wrong. It's also a little bit insane because it suggests that by calling the election for Obama now, that's somehow actually going to influence voters. I don't see why either one would be the case, but hey, for whatever reason, he's become someone a lot of conservatives are trying to attack. His book's fantastic.
It has influenced you. Didn't you bring this up in one email when you were talking about why we've had so many divergent opinions lately?
I did.
This was the book you referenced,
I did, actually.
Right?
Yeah. Nate Silver's book is the reason why I've decided
that. He's got the answer to everything.
He does have the answer to everything. I'm a hedgehog and you're a fox.
That's where it is.
And
yeah,
that's where our disagreements come from. So I can't give Nate Silver the credit for that. That goes way back to Isaac Berlin, I believe, is the thinker's name. But it is something Nate Silver covers in detail in The Signal and the Noise. So if you really want to know not just who's going to win the election, but you want to know why we are the way we are, which is really more important.
It's all
frankly,
in there. Huh?
If you're a Film Spotting listener, it's all in Nate Silver's book, The Signal and the Noise. And I do heartily recommend it.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
Smile again, smile again. One day I hope to make you smile again. I won't hide. Many times I've been told.
Yeah, my father taught me this profession years ago, and now I'm teaching it to my son.
Good.
speak of the devil. Come on. This is Jeffrey. Say hello.
Hi.
Hello. Where you been hiding, this boy?
It's not a bad boy.
Come here. Let me feast my eyes on that boy. Come here. Come here. I'll take a look at you. Hey. Look at the size of him. Look at this. See your mouth. Nice. Nice teeth. You want to sit on Uncle Tim's lap? Get on my knee. I like your son a lot.
All right, Tim.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. That's Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim of Tim and Eric fame from their 2012 movie, Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie. And I wanted to play that clip, Josh, primarily because I just wanted to have listeners hear that scene and without any context or maybe even having not seen the film, try to make sense of why that scene's so hilarious. It's hard to actually make sense of why most of Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie is hilarious. But next week on the show, we are anticipating a conversation with Tim Heidecker about his new movie, The Comedy. He takes a little bit more of a serious turn from his comedic background. So that's also going to set up our top five and this week's poll question. We'll get to that here in a moment. Right now, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a famous screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, Michael Phillips was here and he helped us massacre this scene.
Maybe she just run off on a spree.
No.
There's no harm in hoping.
There's no sense in it, neither. I figured something like that was brewing when she went to bed last night.
How?
Well, she tarried around in the kitchen after I'd gone up. And when I went downstairs to see what was wrong...
What?
Well, she'd found this jar of dandelion wine that the husband at Harper hid summers in the cellar. She was drinking.
Oh.
I tried to save her.
I know you did, Mr. Powell. Oh, I know how hard you tried.
But the devil wins sometimes.
That's Evelyn Vardon as Icy Spoon, Don Bedeau as Walt Spoon, and the great Robert Mitchum as Harry Powell from 1955's Night of the Hunter, directed by Charles Laughton, screenplay by James Agee, with some help from Laughton. And the tie-in, of course, was our top five terrifying characters.
Heather Fraze from Falls Church, Virginia wrote in.
How about that? Falls Church, Virginia. How appropriate for nice. Night of the Hunter and the Reverend Harry Powell.
We planned that. She said, I don't think I would have gotten it if it weren't for Michael's slow transition from the southeastern Wisconsin dialect into Robert Mitchum's drawl. Michael's phrasing of the devil wins sometimes was creepy enough to trigger the image of Reverend Harry Powell.
Thank you, Michael, for your participation last week and your great acting. And thanks to everyone who entered. Unfortunately, a light Film Spotting hat this week, Josh.
That's
once
surprising.
Again, pretty low. More people maybe do need to see that great Charles Laughton film, Night of the Hunter, but why don't you reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner is Joshua Gall from Saratoga Springs, New York.
Congratulations, Joshua. And being from Saratoga Springs, New York, that gives us an opportunity to note that as we're taping this, Hurricane Sandy is just starting to hit, and certainly
right.
Our thoughts are out there with every Film Spotting listener who may be affected by it.
Joshua, we hope you stay safe, and you can email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it even.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
Every week here on the show, we seem to be coming up with new challenges for ourselves in Massacre Theater.
Yeah, this is going to be tough. We're playing stuntmen. We're not just acting.
That's true. We're acting and doing our own stunts.
Yes.
We should be getting hazard pay for this. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. A couple quick notes about this scene. We are going to alter the dialogue just slightly for you purists out there who love this film, because otherwise it would just give it away far too easily. And for our non-radio listeners, note that you may need some earmuffs. If the kids are listening in the car, it's going to get a little bit blue just for a moment.
We've been clean for a while.
We have been clean for a while. And the tie-in, probably pretty easy for people who will recognize this scene, is our top five this week. Multiple role performances. In this scene, we each only play one character, though.
Yes, that's true.
I think that'll probably be pretty obvious, though. As we said, we are also having to be our own stuntmen. So with all that out of the way, Josh, are you ready for this?
I think so. We'll give it a try.
You started off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
So you say you can have a woman who obeys your every command, but you'd rather have a woman who has an opinion.
Only dogs are meant to obey. If you truly love your wife, you will value her opinion.
Hippopotamus shit. Your wife need only have a pretty face, a firm backside, and big breasts like cassava melons.
So you would share your bed and your fortune with a beautiful fool?
That is the way it has always been with men of power. It is tradition.
It is also tradition that times must and always do change, my friend.
And scene.
You know what film? We just brutally massacred. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, November 6th. You don't need to include your own sound effects.
Those were on a very low budget, too, and pretty impressive.
Very low.
Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Con la frente marchita, la nieve del tiempo, platearon mi cielo, sentí.
The sweet sounds of Penelope Cruz, the star of Pedro Almodovar's film Volver. That's the title song from Volver, and that eases us nicely into our poll results from last week. We were anticipating our discussion of Cloud Atlas, the new film from the directing team of Tom Tykwer and the Wachowskis. The Wachowskis, of course, Chicago-born filmmakers, Tom Tykwer, a German director, and their collaboration got us thinking about potential future American-European collaborations we'd like to see. So our question simply was, which of these European directors should make a film with a set of our favorite American directing siblings, the Coen brothers? We gave you these options: Pedro Almodovar, Michael Haneke, Lars von Trier, or Wim Wenders. Josh, how did it come out?
Wim Wenders is in last place with 11%. Not much interest there. Michael Haneke with 28%. Very close to Lars von Trier with 30%. And just squeaking out the win, Pedro Almodovar, 31%.
Maybe not a big surprise. He's a great filmmaker, a revered filmmaker. And I know a lot of Film Spotting listeners are Almodovar fans, but a lot of Film Spotting listeners are also Lars von Trier fans. Here's the reasoning from one listener named Joe. He says, you could toss von Trier and Wenders, neither of them really having the same sense of humor as the Coens, who play equal parts drama and comedy. Haneke, on the other hand, is probably too similar that you get a whatever work situation where the collaboration adds little. Pedro Almodovar, I think, is perfect. Though their styles are similar on the technical side, Almodovar brings a pathos and sensuality that the Coens could use in their sometimes cold, detached style. And speaking of cold, we've seen plenty of the steamy, erotic world of Madrid. I want to see the snowy, erotic world of Minneapolis.
Nice.
Well said. Well said. Before we get to Micah's thoughts, Josh, you chose not to vote last week. Have you thought about it? Do you have?
Of course I thought about it. I was so chastised for taking the poll lightly.
And rightfully.
So I spent hours poring over these options and came away with, I'm going to go with Wim Wenders, actually. The reasoning is the Coens have frequently touched on spiritual themes, but very lightly in a number of their films, whereas Wenders comes at that quite heavily often. So throw those two together, see which one comes out on top. That's my choice.
Well, I think it's a good choice. I think I also actually failed to put in a vote last week. And at
amidst
this point,
all the chastising of me, we didn't realize that you hadn't voted.
I don't know what you're talking about. I think Sam sent you a nice, polite note, said you should vote, and you should. And I do think I got sidetracked as well. It means nothing now because he won for me to say that I'd go with Almodovar, but I think he did put it well. I think that there's something about the Coens. I love their work. They're probably my favorite filmmakers working today, but that is a common criticism of them, whether I think it's valid or not, that they're sometimes a little too cold and detached and analytical, and Pedro Almodovar is anything but those things. So I'd love to see that kind of collaboration, and I'd like to see what he could do with Minneapolis as well. We also got this note from Micah.
I had to go Haneke. I feel like his sense of mature dread in everything he does would complement the stylish wit and creativity of the Coens. Frankly, I couldn't predict what kind of movie these three directors would make, but I know it would be worth seeing.
Our thanks again to everybody who voted in last week's poll. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and vote in this week's poll. As we think about our top five for next week, it ties in with our upcoming conversation with Tim Heidecker about his film, The Comedy. You've got a comedic actor taking a more dramatic turn. And obviously, we've seen a fair number of these over the history of cinema, enough that we think we can come up with two pretty decent top five lists. So you have that to look forward to next week. Our poll question along those lines asks you, which comic actor slash comedian do you think is most likely to surprise with an Oscar nominated dramatic turn? You have a lot of options.
Yeah, a handful for you here. Tina Fey, Sacha Baron Cohen, Ricky Gervais, Zach Galifianakis, Amy Poehler, Kristen Wiig, or Rainn Wilson?
All right, I'm putting you on the spot first. Notice how I did that because I don't have an answer yet. Josh, which one would you vote for? Who do you think is most likely of that group of seven to potentially win an Oscar for a serious performance?
I actually think there's an easy one here, Zach Galifianakis. I mean, he already tried to go in that direction and showed success for a couple of films, so yeah. I could see that happening. After that, I'd go with Kristen Wiig, though, as the one who might be a surprise, but I could see it happening. I'd pick her.
Well, as much as I hate to agree with you, Galifianakis was where I was going as well. We look forward to seeing what you come up with. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you'll see a link there right at the top of the page for the Stitcher Awards. Stitcher, of course, is an app that a lot of Film Spotting listeners use to access the podcast, and they recently announced finalists in a variety of different categories for Best Podcast, and there was a Best TV and Film category, Josh, and we were one of the six nominees there.
How about that?
Six finalists. We appreciate everyone who went to Stitcher and voted for us, and of course, it wouldn't be bad to win. I don't know what we get if we win, but I like to win if we can, so the voting ends for this round November 5th. I know by the time many of you hear this, that might be too late, but if you are hearing it in time, you can vote once a day. There are also a lot of other great shows that I love to support who are nominated, our friends at the Slate Culture Gab Fest. This American Life, Sound Opinions from WBEZ, they also got nominated. So we encourage you to vote in the Stitcher Awards. You can find more information and a link in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Also, always want to encourage our listeners to subscribe to hear Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore and our sister show, Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. Just do a search in iTunes for that show. It comes out every 2 weeks. Always get great stuff from them. And also wanted to plug our bonus content. Josh, every week we try to give listeners a little bit extra. Listeners who have the Film Spotting app, which you can get via iTunes, or if you're an Android user, you can get it from the Amazon Android App Store. And this week, we're going to dive into a little bit of feedback on our recent fight/debate about Argo.
Oh, are we? Argo time.
We are. I've been punching the bag. I've been doing some calisthenics.
Yeah.
I think I'm ready.
Are you really?
Yeah. So we encourage you to check out our bonus content. Always engaging stuff there, we hope. Sometimes not so engaging, sometimes just totally trivial. But hey, that's why it's bonus content. Again, more information about that at our website, filmspotting.net. Just click apps.
I'm your mama. I'm your daddy. I'm that nigga in the alley. I'm your doctor when in need. Want some coke? Have some weed. You know me. I'm your friend. Your main boy. Thick and thin. I'm your pusher man.
We return to our Blaxploitation marathon this week with 1972's Superfly, which stars Ron O'Neill as a New York City drug dealer trying to quit the business. These marathons are chances for us to spend some time focusing on one particular genre or filmmaker. We thought Blaxploitation would be fitting this fall in advance of Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. I mentioned Tarantino because I want to start our discussion of Superfly with this question of influence. Even more so than Shaft, Adam, I saw Superfly as a clear precursor to Tarantino's sensibility. I think we'd both agree that this has largely been a positive influence on Tarantino's work. Yet I also recognized elements of Superfly in other less encouraging forms of pop culture post-1972, namely many of the inferior misogynistic blaxploitation films that would follow, not to mention the materialistic strain of rap music that would flourish in the 1980s. I've talked before about how it's unfair when critics hold the likes of Star Wars and Jaws responsible for the soulless Hollywood blockbusters that came in their wake, claiming the Lucas Spielberg films themselves were worth less because of their influence. In your mind, Adam, does Superfly get a similarly bad rap? Is there more to the movie than the influential surface elements, the pimped-out car, the criminal lifestyle that some of its heirs have latched upon?
That's a great question. I thought, though, you were going to go the same direction you went with Shaft a couple of weeks ago here in our marathon, where you were going to ask me about the music, because once again, it's amazing.
Oh, it's so crucial, yeah.
It probably is, just like with Shaft and Isaac Hayes, my favorite part of the movie, but that isn't a slight on Superfly at all. The music just happens to be that good. I don't know that we're ever going to hear anything in this marathon better than Pusher Man, for example. Curtis Mayfield really is just such a talent. But in terms of your question, I don't really want to speculate on how it compares to its successors because I just don't feel like I have much basis for where Blaxploitation went after this. That's partly why we're doing the marathon, and I'm far from an expert on hip-hop in the 80s or 90s, but I do know that if this film is being written off by anyone then or now because they see it as glorifying the criminal lifestyle or it's just a surface-level film, then yes, it is getting a bad rap, because I think that is definitely unfair. And in fact, as much as we both like Shaft a couple of weeks ago, I think this is a much more ambitious movie than Shaft was. That's not completely fair to say, actually, in defense of Shaft, because, of course, this was the movie that came later, and that was a movie made by Gordon Parks Sr. You had Melvin Van Peebles and his work. Other people paved the way for Gordon Parks Jr. here and Superfly. But I do think it's more ambitious because ultimately, as we discussed, Shaft was offering a new spin, a black spin, on familiar white heroes like Sam Spade and James Bond. So the filmmakers had something to work from and respond to, and it was bold and really entertaining. But Superfly offers, I think, an original black hero. He's a coke dealer, he's a pimp, he's getting rich off the vices of his own people. And sure, the movie gets to have its cake and eat it, too. We see all the cool elements of Shaft. This character Ron O'Neill plays, Priest Youngblood is his name. He's tough, he's smart, he's cool, he's a sex machine, and he beats Whitey at his own game. That's also a crucial part of the film. But at the same time, there is this element of social commentary where you have a character realizing that he's just been playing a hand he was dealt, and he's trying to break away from it. He's trying to get off the streets. I actually think the whole movie for me is summed up in a conversation he has with his girlfriend named Georgia when he tells her why he's getting out of the business.
What do you do when you get out?
I don't know. Not so much for what we do. It's having a choice. Being able to decide what it is I want. Not just to be forced into a thing because that's the way it is. Gonna buy me some time, baby. Some time that isn't all f***ed up with things we gotta do. Just to be free.
And will that make you happy?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know I can't be happy the way it is now. I never was.
Like we talked about with Shaft, a character who is always doing it his own way, is always being completely independent, even as he's straddling the white world and the black world. He's beholden to nobody, certainly nobody within the establishment. Here you have this character, Priest, who says all he wants is to have a choice. He just wants to be able to decide what it is he wants. He doesn't know what he wants, but he knows that he needs his freedom to make that decision for himself.
That's just one of the many introspective conversations that take place in this film. There's a lot of soul searching or just trying to figure out what Priest's identity is, who he wants to be. He seems to have independence. He has this drug business. He has money. He's outside of the law, yet at the same time, and he directly acknowledges this, he doesn't feel free. He still feels the pressure, and he feels like he's being used by various forces. And we find out towards the end how true that really is. I was struck by how sorrowful this movie is. And I guess that should have been clear to me, because when you sit back and really listen to the Curtis Mayfield music, it's not something that's, you know, full of joy or happiness. No. Or excitement, or where you think of the Shaft song, you know, which is kind of more along those lines. This is a
much
really
more playful,
sad music, and it echoes what's going on in this film, which is a lament. It's a lament about being in this community, having the one option for a young black man for success, which is illegal, selling drugs. The characters talk about this too, how it's a raw deal, but it's the only option they have. And yet even that in its own form is a trap. And it goes about all of this in a very non-moralistic way. There's never really any consideration of whether Priest is getting sick of this because he feels guilty. He's getting sick of it really because he realizes it's just another trap,
yeah,
a dead end for him. And I think Ron O'Neill's performance is pretty amazing here,
I agree,
actually, in that he lets this sorrow come through. You talk about the coats and the outfits he wears, and that's what we all remember, but he wears them like they weigh 1,000 pounds on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got the style and the strut with them, but at the same time, he walks around throughout this film bearing this load that he can't get out of this business. And that's how he plays every scene. Even the sex scenes, he's distracted during them and not really, you know, focusing on what you think a movie is going to allow this scene to focus on. He can't do it because he's constantly thinking about how can he get out of this business and find a true independent life.
That's a great connection you make between the Curtis Mayfield soundtrack and the movie, because you're right. The Mayfield score is very upbeat. It's got a great tempo. You could walk into a club and hear it and want to dance to it, or you could also just sit back and not move at all and listen to it and take it very seriously and hear how plaintive
and that's
and how
thoughtful
it
works in the context of the movie.
That's how it works in the context of the film, and it does sum up the entire film where, yes, certain audience members could watch it and embrace just the lifestyle and see the cool car and the hats and the clothes, or you could really see what it seems Gordon Parks Jr. here as the director is really wanting to explore. And we spent so much time with Shaft talking about that great opening sequence. I think you have to mention it here. It's not an accident that you've got Gordon Parks Sr.'s son directing this movie. And this movie opens just like Shaft,
yep,
with an aerial shot zooming in on a character, in this case two characters, on the street. But unlike Shaft, we only hear a little bit of the music. It isn't that pounding, pulsating Isaac Hayes. We hear the Curtis Mayfield just starting to come up a little bit. The first thing we actually hear, and it's perfect for the film, is we hear these two junkies on the street, and one of them says, "You get the money? I ain't got nothing. She wouldn't give it to me." That tells you right away you're watching a completely different type of film than what we saw with Shaft, where Richard Roundtree is strutting down the street, going past those theater marquees, showing us a new type of Hollywood hero. There's no glamour here. The stores are Wilbur's wigs, wholesale cigars, dilapidated buildings everywhere.
It's a totally different street.
It is. And you really got the sense watching Shaft that he was the king of New York. Priest here seems to be the king of the underworld, New York, and it is worth noting that we don't see him for the first 3 or 4 minutes of this film. We see these two characters, and then we see where they connect later. But these characters are his minions. These are the people that are sprung out of the line of work he's in, and I love that kind of thoughtfulness that we see right away from this film.
The opening scene of Shaft is all about confidence, and the opening here is all about desperation.
You got it.
You mentioned Gordon Parks Jr., and I want to spend some time talking a little bit about the still photo sequence that I think is really the crucial sequence here for Superfly, especially in terms of setting it apart from Shaft. It's basically 8 minutes of a series of still photographs that trace Priest purchasing this huge amount of cocaine and then his employees cutting it up for sale, then going out on the street, selling it, notably not just in the neighborhood, but it traces it all the way to the white purchasers.
Yeah,
There's a construction worker and then some sort of white collar guy,
mm-hmm,
and follows through to them enjoying it as well. And we get this whole sense of the business that Priest is involved in with these really striking still photographs that Gordon Parks Jr. took. And it reminded me of nothing less than Steven Soderbergh's Traffic. I felt like I had just seen Traffic in 8 minutes, essentially. It's,
yeah,
really an amazing sequence.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking about the 1972 blaxploitation classic Superfly. It's part of our ongoing blaxploitation marathon. I love your take on that 8-minute sequence, and I think ultimately you're right, especially having rewatched it today. But I have to admit that the first time I saw it, as much as I loved the music, because I'll watch anything, literally anything, set to Curtis Mayfield's Pusher Man, it's that good. But my first instinct watching it was, it seemed to me a little bit like filler. It seemed to me like Parks Jr. didn't have enough material. It's already a fairly short film, right around 90 minutes. There's a love scene as well earlier in the film that's in a bathtub, where I applaud the fact that he's trying something grittier and trying something much more artistic than the love scenes or any scene we see in Shaft. But the audio that seems to be in real time, juxtaposed with these slow motion gauzy images of their bodies in the tub, isn't really interesting to me at all. And that too felt like a case where maybe Gordon Parks was trying to elongate this a little bit to stretch this movie out. But I'm saying I was wrong. If you watch it again, as I did, you do recognize how it traces that sale from the beginning on through to the end. And you really see how far this drug business goes. So I embrace that sequence, but I'm just confessing that the first time I saw it, I thought, okay, this is a really cool little bit that you added maybe to stretch this film out. I don't really think that's true. So,
okay, good. Well, then let me defend the bathtub scene actually as
okay.
well, because there is a wooziness to that scene
yeah.
that I can't think of any other similar type scene a movie has had. And I love where it comes to an end. First of all, it's an important scene on its own because Priest again is distracted at the beginning of that scene where they're in the bathtub. And the way it brings them around to show that they have a different relationship than these other women he's involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's key in him playing out his plan to get out of the business.
True.
So there's value in that. But then it proceeds to have this sort of slow motion you mentioned with the music and this wooziness. And bang, it cuts right out of that to this fight scene on the street that is such a juxtaposition that I think those work so well to remind us of we're still in
mm-hmm.
this ghetto where this is all going on.
That's a great point, but I'd actually argue that the real bravura sequence in this movie is one that stands out because of its simplicity, and it's because of what we're talking about with some of these more artistic flourishes, but it's a scene between Priest, his partner, played by Carl Lee, and the character named Scatter, who is the guy who got him started in the business. He's really what Priest is probably going to become and sees himself becoming, and he doesn't want to be that guy who's working as a chef in a restaurant and is trying to get out of the business and is old and tired, and he wants to avoid that and live the life that he thinks he's maybe entitled to or deserves. And they're in the back of this restaurant. I think it's 6 minutes or so total, and it's just really well cut, emphasizes all the right beats, doesn't have a ton of cutting in it. But then the last 2.5 minutes or so of the sequence is just a single shot. It's a three shot of those characters, and we just get to watch all the drama play out in front of us. No soundtrack, like I said, no other flourishes, no cuts, just the human drama, Youngblood, his partner, and as I said, the man he respects but doesn't want to become. And when Gordon Parks does that, when he restrains himself and allows the camera just to show those three in that conversation, you know that conversation is a crucial one to this film. And it really is. You know that it's determining his entire future from there.
Yeah, that's Julius Harris who plays Scatter, and that's a really good performance, too. You're right. That is a crucial scene because of all the different power dynamics that are going on in what is essentially a business deal that Priest is trying to negotiate. So, yeah, this is a rich movie in its more ostentatious elements, but also those quieter ones, like you mentioned.
Well, obviously, Superfly is another successful entry in our Blaxploitation marathon, and I think in a lot of ways, as we've touched on, a nice follow-up to Shaft, but also taking the marathon in a different direction, and certainly with the third film coming up, we're going to go in yet another direction as we get to Pam Grier and her film Coffee. Right now, our plan is to discuss Coffee on next week's show. Of course, things are subject to change with our schedule, but if you're looking to get caught up with the marathon, we encourage you to do so. You can get full details about our Blaxploitation marathon lineup at filmspotting.net. Just click on the marathon's link.
Well, I personally feel the top five multiple role performances all belong to Eddie Murphy for his inspirational work as the Klump family.
Hercules, Hercules.
That was great. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Tell me a tale that always was. Sing me a song that I'll always hear. Tell me a story that I can read. Tell me a story that I believe. Paint me a picture that I can see. Give me a touch that I can feel. Turn me around so I can be everything I was meant to be. Lord, I need loving. Lord, I need good, good loving.
Well, Massacre Theater may be everyone else's favorite part of the show, but the donation segment is my favorite part of the show. It's where we get to say thank you to all of our listeners who've generously helped donate some money and supported Film Spotting. We'll get to those thank yous here in a second. Just a couple of quick notes. We always want to plug our friend Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, which you can get in iTunes. This week, he brings you a TCM festival chat with Norman Lloyd about acting in Alfred Hitchcock's Saboteur. I haven't had a chance yet to see The Girl, I think that's what it's called. It's the HBO series that documents his relationship with Tippi Hedren. It's about the birds, is it not?
That's my impression, yeah.
I'm drawing a blank for some reason, but I'm pretty sure that is what it's about. So a nice connection there. Jeff notes that Lloyd went on to produce and direct TV's Alfred Hitchcock Presents and the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. So he's got a lot of great stories to tell if you want to check those out.
Jeff also just put Backstory Issue 03 out on the iPad, so it's available there. Each issue is filled with filmmaker interviews. He's got full-length scripts, short films, all sorts of stuff. And for those zombie fans out there, this issue is going to feature 6 zombie-centric pieces, including a sit-down with The Walking Dead showrunner Glenn Mazzara.
The Walking Dead is one of those series I do actually want to catch up with at some point. It's just in line at number 12 or so with all the TV series I need to see.
It's a hard sell for me at home, too. TV series are a joint thing at our house, and my wife just isn't into the zombie thing like I am. So those are solo viewings.
Well, maybe at some point down the road, you can come over to my house
there
and we'll
go.
Watch it.
Zombie
we'll watch
night.
It together. Zombie night at the Kempinar house. Another note this week on our featured artist, Michael Kiwanuka. This is a recommendation that came from our producer, Sam Van Halgren. Always very plugged in, always knows what the latest and greatest tunes are out there. And he sent this a few weeks ago, and I only recently caught up with it. And especially, I'm sure you heard it in this last song we just played, seemed just like a perfect fit for our Blaxploitation marathon. There's a similar sound there to Curtis Mayfield. And after I sent that note to Sam and said, we got to play him, I went to Spotify, and in his little bio, they actually do compare him directly to Curtis Mayfield. So I'm not completely crazy. Really great artist. We hope you enjoy his sounds this week. That brings us to our thank yous and our donors this past week. We start with a new $10 a month subscriber, Byron in gorgeous Honolulu, Hawaii.
Aloha, film spotters. Loved your Halloween edition. I burst out loud laughing to myself when Michael Phillips described The Shining as a dark comedy about a particular American family that gets what they deserve. His dry wit and delivery was the funniest thing I've heard all year. And yes, he is my favorite guest of your show, and The Shining is beloved by me. Adam, it always amazes me that whenever you guys do express contradictory opinions about a film or a particular scene, your insights are so sharp, I often find myself agreeing with you both. That this has always been the case, from Sam to Maddie to Josh, it only goes to show the quality of Film Spotting and why it is the best podcast radio show. You guys are fantastic, and I look forward to hearing you every week. Mahalo nui loa. I hope, Byron, I got that ending correctly.
I think you got it, and all I can say is yay us. Thank you very much, Byron. That's really kind of you. Really appreciate those thoughts on the show. A new $5 a month subscriber, Rebecca, out in Oakland. And we also have a new Silver Club donor. This is Pat Boberg in Altoona, Iowa. Not very far, Josh, from Pleasant Hill, Iowa, where I saw Cloud Atlas last weekend.
Really? How about that?
Yeah.
Pat writes, hey guys, after enjoying the show for 5 years, I decided it was time to make a donation, however paltry, after listening to the Argo discussion. I actually got into it a little back and forth with Josh via his Facebook page, disagreeing with his take. Ah, so that's where that was coming from. Mm-hmm. Altoona, Iowa, huh? I eventually gave up the quest because I figured Adam would disagree much more eloquently than my Facebook post could. Bravo, Adam, bravo. This show never disappoints to engage, entertain, and inform, and hopefully down the line I can make a greater contribution to the cause. If I could sneak in a plug for my film blog, filmcastwithoutacause.com, and say thanks for years of introductions to films I might have otherwise missed.
I guess there's just some major disagreement between Josh Larson and people from Iowa.
People of Iowa.
It just... There's a disconnect there of some kind. We also want to thank one last donor. Speaking of our disagreements here on the show, Josh, Breton in Newton, Mass. writes in.
After listening to the bonus content that covered Josh's first time viewing of 12 Angry Men, I am compelled to make a modest donation. See, all these people get angered and then give us money.
I love it. Let's keep fighting, Josh. Let's just find reasons to argue even if we don't mean it.
It was one of the most entertaining moments for me in a long while. I found myself agreeing with everything Josh said about the film, nearly all of it negative, except for one thing. I still think it's a good movie. Adam, on the other hand, seemed to be saying that you can't hold the film's flaws against it or something. Anyway, great show.
That is pretty much my take on 12 Angry Men.
Love that.
I think he summed it up nicely, that bonus content conversation. Anyone who heard it knows that it wasn't really about 12 Angry Men at all. It was supposed to be about 30 seconds, Josh, of you saying, yeah, I saw it. Good movie. Or even I saw
no.
Didn't really work for me. But
I couldn't just leave it at that.
No, you couldn't leave it at that. And not to rehash it, but you said something about its lack of subtlety and its didacticism. And what struck me about that was just that I can't argue with that. That really is the way you'd sum up the film. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I think those are its defining characteristics. So that whole bonus content became about how do you really talk about a film where you agree completely on a major aspect of the film, but see it in completely different ways.
Yeah,
that's what
bonus
it was.
Content went off the rails.
It did go completely off the rails. And poor Tyler here, who helps us out with
I
our
know,
live events, he just
part.
Had to sit here while we fought with each other. I felt so bad for Tyler later. Not my most gracious hosting job there. I apologize for that, Tyler. Thanks as always, though, to our very generous donors.
Tell me a story that I can read. Tell me a story that I can read.
Hi, this is Lynn Shelton, director of Hump Day and Your Sister's Sister. You are listening to Film Spotting.
I'm not mad.
I don't want to die. There's someone within me, and she says I must die. Oh, Scotty, don't let me go.
I'm here. I've got you.
I'm so afraid.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Kim Novak playing dual roles in Alfred Hitchcock's classic film Vertigo. She's Madeline Elster. She's also Judy Barton. And that sets up our top five this week, inspired by our discussion of Cloud Atlas. Multiple role performances. Vertigo, certainly a film that has gotten a lot of love, not only from us here recently on the show, but from film critics in general, as we touched on during our Sight and Sound show. That poll that comes out every decade recognizing the top 10 greatest films ever. This was the year that Vertigo supplanted Citizen Kane as the number one movie ever made, according to critics. And as we were putting together our list this week of our favorite multiple role performances, it occurred to us that Vertigo was bound to get a lot of love. Kim Novak in particular would probably be our number one choice.
Yep.
So we realized it's just time. It's just time that we induct a movie. This is actually your first induction into the Film Spotting Pantheon, Josh.
Oh, wow. Are there going to be confetti or anything like that?
Something. There should be singing, rays of light, something to commemorate this. But we're going to go ahead and just make it official. Vertigo needs to be recognized. It needs to be put in the Film Spotting Pantheon for all time as one of our favorite films, a film that we acknowledge as one of the greatest films ever made. And now it's going to be exempt for all time from appearing on a Film Spotting Top 5 list.
That's it. You just speak the words and it's happened.
Boom.
Amazing.
It's there. A little bit of music, a little bit of E.T. there. That's what we like to use to officially anoint a movie into the Pantheon. So you heard it. It's official. Vertigo in the Film Spotting Pantheon. If you want to check out our complete list of Pantheon films, go to the top five section of filmspotting.net. But we have a lot to get to with this week's show, recognizing our favorite performances by actors or actresses playing more than one role. Josh, get us started.
Yeah, we did focus on the performances, obviously, not the movies themselves. I tried to take into account degree of difficulty a little bit when I looked at it. And keep in mind that I'm of the school that comedy is probably harder than drama. So that might have influenced my list. So at number five, I'm going to bring up a name here, Adam, you may initially balk at. So try not to panic. Eddie Murphy. I don't mean Norbit. I don't mean The Clumps, which you recalled with your great impression. I'm going to go with 1999's Bowfinger, written by and starring Steve Martin, directed by Frank Oz. In Bowfinger, Martin plays a desperate and shady Hollywood producer who tries to make a low-budget alien flick with action star Kit Ramsey, who's played by Murphy. But he tries to do this without Ramsey knowing it. So it's this guerrilla style where he has his other actors run up to Ramsey on the street, say a line from the movie, and then run away, and they kind of film his befuddled reaction. Well, of course, this isn't really going to work. So among other things they also have to do is find a stand-in. So they find a Kit Ramsey lookalike, this rube named Jeff, who's also played by Murphy.
So now you're action. You are going to run from point A over there to point B over here.
That seems kind of high.
Well, you know, think of it as an errand. Your errand is to run across the freeway until I yell cut.
I get it. But doesn't it seem a little dangerous, though?
No. We have professional stuntmen doing the driving, so you'll be completely safe.
Oh, professional stuntmen. That's how they do it. I was wondering how they did that. Stunt drivers.
Okay, you ready to do one?
Sure, they're going really fast.
Now, Murphy isn't just tolerable here. He's actually very good. There's a lot of self-satire going on as Kit Ramsey, and it doesn't seem to be that he followed his own advice, considering this was made a while ago, and he continued to do the sort of things he's spoofing here. But he's very good spoofing himself, and he's also quite funny, though quite a bit more broad, as Jif. I think Bowfinger is a fine little movie on its own. There are a lot of funny jokes here. And at its best, it captures some of the affectionately satirical tone of something like Preston Sturges' Sullivan Travels. I'm not putting it in that class at all, but I'm just saying that's the vibe it's kind of going for. And it does hit it here or there.
It does hit it here or there. I think fine little movies may be the way to put it. Bowfinger, for me, is a movie I applaud the premise of more than maybe the execution of, but I do really love Eddie Murphy's performance in that movie. There are other good performances in Bowfinger as well. Before I get to my number five, do want to mention two other films that aren't going to make my list. The Wizard of Oz is a film that's also in the Film Spotting Pantheon. I don't know if it would have made my top five, but clearly in the two sequences there, the Kansas and the Oz sequences, mm-hmm. you have characters playing more than one role. And also a movie like Vertigo that seems to have come up a lot recently, Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch film. Naomi Watts' dual performance as Betty Elms and Diane Selwyn is one of my all-time favorites, but Mulholland Drive is in my penalty box. So
yeah, that's going to be in the Pantheon pretty soon, I suspect.
I hope it will one day be in the Film Spotting Pantheon. My number five multiple role performance is Deborah Carr in a triple role from the Powell Pressburger film, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. She plays Edith Hunter, Barbara Wynn, and Johnny Cannon. And she seemed to me not only a must for this list because I love this movie and her performances, but because of its connection to Cloud Atlas. You have three different storylines going on where they're extended flashbacks filling us in on the life of Major General Clive Wynne Candy, played by Roger Livesey. The Boer War is one sequence, the First World War is another, and the Second World War. And Carr plays different parts in all three. In the first one, she's Edith, this socialite who's assisting the British Army in Berlin. In the second, she's Barbara, a nurse. And in the third, she's the general's personal driver. And in each sequence, her resemblance to the other characters is noted by characters in the movie. There's a sense that there's a connection between all three, something almost mystical that's linking, for example, the third character, Johnny, to Barbara and to Edith, that the characters who come in contact with are all recognize and are drawn to. So I love that mystical aspect of the film. And the way Carr inhabits all three characters, she makes them distinct. You see the refined elegance in Edith, the passion and inquisitiveness of Barbara, the plain-spoken pluckiness of Johnny. She's just really good in all three roles. And I went back and looked at my notes from our Powell Pressburger marathon a few years ago here on Film Spotting, and I did have a line in there where I mentioned how much I enjoyed watching Deborah Carr in other Powell Pressburger films throughout the marathon, and this one in particular, and wondered if one day we should do a Deborah Carr marathon because she's that talented of an actress, and there's plenty of her films I haven't seen.
I'm glad you put Deborah Carr on your list because I saw that come up quite a bit from listeners on Twitter and so forth. For my number four, I went with Elsa Lanchester as both Mary Shelley and the bride in The Bride of Frankenstein.
She's alive! Alive!
It isn't only the hair that makes her iconic in this 1935 sequel to Frankenstein, though that's probably what we're all thinking of. Frankenweenie actually has a great visual gag involving that with a poodle. But she has this dead stare that's so creepy when the bride comes alive. And then for whatever reason, she chooses to give her quick movements of the head. She's sort of like a frightened bird in that scene. She really only has essentially the last climactic scene as the bride. This is the one where Boris Karloff's monster comes up to her and says, "Friend," and she just gives this scream in response. It's kind of like every junior high boy's nightmare of what will happen at the dance when they ask a girl to dance with them, just to get that scream in response.
Friend?
And of course, the monster, he's so distraught by this, he goes to pull the lever that's going to bring down the whole laboratory around them. And there's this great shot, again, of Lanchester where the bride looks, realizes what's going to happen, and gives this terrible hiss. It just lends this other element to what's sort of a deranged Romeo and Juliet type finale to it. So she's really good in that final scene. But you might ask, well, what good does it do to have her also play Mary Shelley, who is, of course, the Frankenstein author? They have her do that in this prologue to the film that kind of sets up why they're having this sequel in the first place. Well, there's the meta element, of course, so it's just fun. But there's also the shock later of seeing this familiar face that you saw before, especially because the reveal of the face is so crucial to that climactic scene. So when you see the bride again and you recognize the face a little bit, it gives it another level there. And it's interesting because in the prologue, they do play up, they give Lanchester these dramatic eyebrows and false eyelashes when she's Shelley, which don't really fit, but then you see them echoed later as the bride. And I also think that because she's familiar in that final scene, it makes her that much more human and just makes the finale that much more tragic.
Well, unfortunately, The Bride of Frankenstein is a film I need to catch up with. So
it's a
great pick, though. My number four perfectly ties in with what you were saying, Josh, about the degree of difficulty. That phrase was something I was thinking about a lot as I was considering my picks and as I was numbering my picks, because I was really wrestling with whether or not this actor needed to be higher just based on the degree of difficulty, especially if you do assign more points to someone in a tragic role or a dramatic role over comedy. In contrast to you, and obviously I decided I was going to keep him here at number four rather than vault him up the list. And rather than just name him, I'll see if maybe you can start to piece it together at all in your head. I actually went through a phase in the 90s for a brief time where I was convinced that this guy was our greatest living actor. And in looking back, I might not have been wrong. The Mission, Reversal of Fortune, Damage, M. Butterfly, and this film, David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers. The actor, of course, is Jeremy Irons. And he really had a job here playing Elliot and Beverly Mantle, identical twins and successful gynecologists who both just become progressively unhinged and go to some really dark places as this film goes on. And you think about what makes Irons such an interesting actor. So many of his best roles seethe with this darkness underneath. He's got this sophisticated air and presentation about him, but it always belies something more sinister. And in Dead Ringers, he gets to embody that in two unique separate characters, but he does it in a way where you never get the feeling that they aren't two halves of one whole. It's not a matter of them being split personalities. They're just variations on the same theme. You see the horror in the other. You can see what Elliot sees when he sees Beverly and what Beverly sees when he looks at Elliot. And maybe they start to wonder where it is in themselves. Is it something hiding? Is it something that's going to come out? It's actually a constant reminder, too, I think, of your failures. You see the other and you recognize that he's more serious and maybe more hardworking, but the other one's more confident and successful with women and just more comfortable in his own skin. So it's like every time they look at each other, you're seeing a mirror, but you're also seeing this notion of yourself the way you maybe want to be. And that then reflects back on you and makes you feel even worse about yourself. So it's this kind of vicious cycle with both characters and the performances. And Irons reflects it all in just their energy and in their posture, but in really subtle ways. So Jeremy Irons in Dead Ringers is my number four.
Was this 90s phase also your Z Cavaricci phase?
I don't want to talk about it, okay. But there may be pictures.
I'd love to see them. Number three, I'm going with Mike Myers in Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. Yes, after three Austin Powers films, not to mention the likes of The Love Guru, we understandably shudder at the thought of Mike Myers in a multiple role performance. But the truth is, with this first Austin Powers film, Myers did something really rare. He created two iconic characters in the same film, with Austin Powers and Dr. Evil. I'll admit Powers himself starts to wear thin. His spy, James Bond spoof, even by the end of the first movie, you kind of get it. But Dr. Evil is just a stroke of comic genius, and there are so many good scenes in the film with him. His demand of $1 million. Anything really with his estranged son, Scott, played by Seth Green. Love those sequences. And then, of course, there is his pining for sharks with frickin' lasers.
Right.
You know, I have one simple request, and that is to have sharks with frickin' laser beams attached to their heads. Now, evidently, my cycloptic colleague informs me that that can't be done. Can you remind me what I pay you people for? Honestly, throw me a bone here. What do we have?
Sea bass.
Right.
You're right. Both sequels were pretty terrible, but International Man of Mystery is a very funny movie, and he's great. He's so great. He's an honorable mention for me. I do love him as Dr. Evil and Austin Powers as well, but just didn't quite crack my top five. You're listening to Film Spotting. Our top five this week is multiple role performances, one actor or actress playing more than one character in the same film. And I think my number three had to make this list just out of sheer volume and also the range of the performances. It's Alec Guinness in the film Kind Hearts and Coronets. By my count, he plays eight different members of the Dascoyne family. Male, female, old, young, middle-aged, smart, respectable, dumb, detestable. He covers them all. And of course, many people listening to this know Alec Guinness as I do from Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars, Bridge on the River Kwai. But this film and The Lavender Hill Mob are the only two comedies of him that I've seen, and he's one of those guys who's synonymous with Ealing comedies, which this movie is part of that. There's just such a precision, though, to his comedic performances, this willingness on Guinness's part to be theatrical, the talent to be theatrical, but never overplay a scene. He never forces a laugh. He just lets all of the ironies and hypocrisies and inconsistencies of a character naturally rise to the surface. And as well, I'm just a big fan of this film. I think it's a great satire of the aristocracy, but also a commentary on the insidiousness and the dangers of vanity. But Alec Guinness is a big reason why this film is so good, again, playing eight different roles.
You are absolutely right about the degree of difficulty. That's why I had this as my number two, actually, Alec Guinness. And I came to it also having known him first as Obi-Wan Kenobi. And you might think that's going to be such a barrier because that's such an iconic part and such a distinct non-comedic character at all. And yet, no problem. He's so good in this film that there's no problem setting that aside and appreciating what he's doing here. What I found about it is that the humor is so dry in all the performances. They're all distinct, but they have this dryness to it, which is very different from something like, well, Mike Myers in Austin Powers, or even Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove. You know, it's quite a different approach, yet it does work to make this just a really, really funny film.
I'm glad we're in agreement on Kind Hearts and Coronets. My number two, I guess, does answer the question for me where I stand in terms of what's harder to do, comedy or tragedy, as you dealt with as well, because I really wrestled with whether or not Jeremy Irons, in his dual role playing twins, should be up here at number two, and this actor should be back at number four. I decided I was going to go with Nicolas Cage as Donald Kaufman and Charlie Kaufman from the film Adaptation as my number two. And you can really take everything I said about Irons and Dead Ringers and apply it here, except that you don't necessarily ever feel that Charlie and Donald are two halves of the same whole. In fact, there seems to be almost no chance they could even be related, much less identical twins. That's what's so funny about these roles. And there's a similar dynamic, though, to Elliot and Bev Mantle, in that one's racked with doubt and self-loathing and is horrible with women. The other's brimming with confidence, thinks he can accomplish whatever he sets his mind to, and really is successful with women. And as you watch this movie, you think about how we always think that so much of attraction between a man and a woman or anybody is based on physical appearance. Here you've got two people who look exactly the same, but one gets all the women he wants because of his personality, his sheer force of nature, his confidence, and the way Nicolas Cage embodies those differences in the two characters is so much fun to watch. The one character, Charlie, slouching and sweating, talks in a much more slow, deliberate way. And then Donald is all smiles and passion and energy. And really what you see embodied in the two characters is one character who's just completely cynical and views the world in a cynical way, and another character who views it in an idealistic way and is earnest about everything. And I've said before, I'm a big Nicolas Cage fan. I wish I could see more great performances like the one Nicolas Cage gives in Adaptation. So he's my number two.
Okay, there's a serial killer, right? Well, no, wait. And he's being hunted by a cop, and he's taunting the cop, right? Sending clues who his next victim is. He's already holding her hostage in his creepy basement. So the cop gets obsessed with figuring out her identity, and in the process, falls in love with her. Even though he's never even met her, she becomes like the unattainable, like the Holy Grail.
It's a little obvious, don't you think?
Okay, but here's the twist. We find out that the killer really suffers from multiple personality disorder, right? See, he's actually really the cop and the girl. All of them are him. Isn't that f***ed up?
The only idea more overused than serial killers is multiple personality. On top of that, you explore the notion that cop and criminal are really two aspects of the same person. See every cop movie ever made for other examples of this.
Mom called it psychologically taught.
Honorable mention for me. Great pick. For my number one, though, well, being able to pull off multiple roles is sort of the backbone of sketch comedy. So I had to go with the Monty Python troupe for number one. But the problem is, first you're going to have to choose among the Monty Python movies.
Right.
Then you have to choose among the performances.
The performers. They all play multiple
people. In that film. I know. It wasn't easy, but I went with John Cleese in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, actually. Cleese's main part is that of Sir Lancelot, but he's also credited as second soldier in the opening scene, a man in the plague scene. He plays a villager, a Frenchman, Tim the Enchanter. Funny in all of these parts, some just bit parts. Very good. I chose him mainly for his legendary performance as the indefatigable Black Knight.
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've heard worse.
You liar!
Come on, you pansy!
That scene is just a wonderful setup of fight scenes in general, any sort of fight scene we get. But I also love how it works, and this is almost satire into the future because we got more of this after Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but about how our battle movies, and especially our medieval ones, have to be so gory. The gore is just amped up to a ridiculous level in our movies, and here is Monty Python and the Holy Grail spoofing that before it really started happening.
Well, I'm notorious for not giving Monty Python enough love here on the show. And that's certainly true. I definitely don't talk about those movies much. For me, I gave strong consideration to Monty Python's The Life of Brian. That's my favorite Monty Python film.
So you do
film.
Like them.
I do like them, but maybe just not as much as everyone else.
Sure.
I just don't appreciate them on the level that all those Python heads out there do. But Life of Brian is a brilliant film. And for me, the one that, as I said, I really struggle with putting on my list was Michael Palin, actually.
Okay.
Seeing him play 12 different people, including Pontius Pilate and Mr. Big Nose in Life of Brian, that was one that I really did want to put on my list. For me, though, just an honorable mention, because I had to get on there, my number one, Peter Sellers, in his triple role in the great Stanley Kubrick film, Dr. Strangelove. He plays Group Captain Lionel Mandrake, but more importantly, President Merkin Muffley and Dr. Strangelove himself. I don't know what's more sublime comedically than watching Peter Sellers playing the president, talking to himself as Strangelove, with Strangelove fighting back that right arm that he wants so badly to use to salute the Führer. It's a man at war intellectually, mentally, in that you've got this president, as much as he can be at war with himself intellectually, asking these philosophical questions about what's going to happen next and can I really make these tough decisions, contrasted with a man who's at war with himself physically, even at one point having to punch himself in the face to stop that right arm.
I would guess that dwelling space for several hundred thousand of our people could easily be provided.
Well, I would hate to have to decide who stays up and who goes down.
Well, that would not be necessary, Mr. President. Could easily be accomplished with a computer. And the computer could be set and programmed to accept factors from youth, health, sexual fertility, intelligence, and a cross-section of necessary skills. Of course, it would be absolutely vital that our top government and military men be included to foster and impart the required principles of leadership and tradition.
I assume it's true because I read it on Wikipedia that one of the stipulations with this film for Kubrick was Columbia Pictures said you have to put Peter Sellers in at least four roles because they saw what he did in Lolita, where he played the same character but had all these different disguises and costumes, and said, okay, well, if that's going to work in that movie, then we're going to apply it here, and he has to play at least four. He ended up only playing those three, but a lot of what he did, according to the stories I've read anyway, was improvised, which just adds to the legend of Peter Sellers. Whether it was scripted or not, though, just watching sequences like the one you just heard are everything you need to know about why Peter Sellers had to be my number one multiple role performance. What about some more honorable mentions, Josh?
You just mentioned one. Peter Sellers was one I considered very strongly for the list. And as I mentioned, Nicolas Cage, too, for adaptation. And then I had Armie Hammer for The Social Network. I was just blown away by that performance. I'd seen him in a very small film before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came on and did this, which I just thought was crucial to how that movie worked.
Yeah, absolutely. I also had Armie Hammer as an honorable mention. Mike Myers, Michael Palin, as I said. Charlie Chaplin, Adenoid Hinkle, the dictator of Tomania and the Jewish barber in The Great Dictator, was one I gave strong consideration to. Brigitte Helm from the classic film Metropolis. She plays five different roles there. And one I also just relegated to honorable mention because she came up recently on our list of top five doppelgangers was Irene Jacob, the great French actress playing Veronica and Veronique in Krzysztof Kieślowski's film, The Double Life of Veronique. There are a lot of good options, though, and I'm sure we're going to hear some great feedback from our listeners. Those are our top five multiple role performances. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release this week, all three of these movies are opening here in Chicago and select cities: A Late Quartet, Nobody Walks, and The Loneliest Planet. Of the three, that's the one that seems to be getting the most acclaim. It's the one I'm most interested in seeing. It stars Gael Garcia Bernal. Out in wide release, the new film from Robert Zemeckis, Flight, The Man with the Iron Fist, and the family comedy Wreck-It Ralph, which my son is dying to see.
It looks like it could be pretty good.
It could be decent. I have a feeling I'm going to have to find out this weekend. Next week on the show, we are planning right now an interview with Tim Heidecker about his new film, The Comedy. We'll get to Coffee, the third film on our Blaxploitation Marathon, and our top five actor departures, but specifically actors who are comic actors who are going dramatic.
Oh, we are going to narrow it down that way.
I think we're going to go that way.
That's
what you wanted, right?
Yeah, I like it.
It works for me.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Michael Kiwanuka. Learn more at michaelkiwanuka.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.